serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting to know a soon-to-be centenarian today. Vic Freudenberger spent more than 22 years in the Marine Corps, starting in 1938. We heard about how he was wounded on the first day of the Battle of Guadalcanal in 1942, how coming back to the States allowed him to meet his wife, two kids, five grandkids, and seven great-grandkids later. Vic is still going strong, but he had to survive some extreme conditions in the Korean War as well. We left off at the end of World War II. He'd been preparing for the invasion of Japan when the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki hastened the Japanese surrender.
So I was there on Guam until next year, in January, I was transferred back to Hawaii to the Ordnance Depot. And so I immediately called my wife, and it took her a while to get out because the Navy wasn't providing any transportation. But she came out in March on a Norwegian steamer. So we had a great time for about 3 months. In June, we received orders to come back to the States. Received orders back to Ordnance School, where I became in charge of the ammunition section. Of course, I was still a warrant officer. I had there for 3 years, which is great because it was like living in a country club. We had horseback riding every Sunday. We had sailing on the river, and the officers' club had a party every Saturday night. So it was like living in a country club. So we had a great tour of duty there. Our first daughter was born in December of 46. So we were transferred back to Camp Pendleton to the 1st Division. We were happy about that. By then we decided that California was where we were going to live because of the climate being so wonderful. Got to the 1st Division in January of 1950. We decided to buy a house, but we couldn't find two-bedroom, one house. It was all they had, one bath. So there was a new subdivision being built, so we signed up for that. And that was just 2 weeks before Korea popped. And so about February 26th or 27th of 1950, Korea was invaded. The division immediately started preparing to go overseas. But during that time from 1945 to 1950, the Marine Corps had gone from 500,000 down to 60,000, which wasn't, and that's scattered all over the country. The 1st Marine Division actually consisted of one infantry regiment instead of three, one regiment, one battalion of artillery. In other words, it was a third of a division. Mm-hmm. And the same thing was in Camp Lejeune. So in 30 days, fortunately, the Marines had a reserve of about 10,000. So all the reserves were called up to active duty, and they became the 3rd Regiment. It was the 1st, the 5th, and the 7th. So in that short time, the division prepared and went overseas. Well, before the division left, the Korea was almost lost. There was a regiment from Camp Pendleton and what they call a brigade, because it had the regiment and artillery and supporting arms. And they went ahead of time. We loaded them out day and night, working day and night to get them undersea. And they arrived in time to save Korea from being gone, because the way the Army had not prepared, most of the troops from the Army were sent in, which were not even combat troops. A lot of them were just occupational troops who were in Japan, and they were sent in piecemeal. Fortunately, the 5th Marine Regiment, and called the Brigade, was able to hold the line and while the rest of the division prepared to make an amphibious landing. So we then went overseas, and September 15th, we landed at Incheon, which was north of where the fighting was going on. And this is General MacArthur at that time made the decision, and it was a critical thing because the tides in Incheon was 30 feet tide, which meant that everything had to be done quickly to get in the original amphibious landing. You only had 8 or 9 hours to land. So it went off successfully. Naturally, that wasn't long before 10 days, and the division was already occupying Seoul. And then, of course, MacArthur wanted to keep going, and instead of stopping at the 32nd parallel, he kept going. We went north, and all the way on well into North Korea. Now we're going to jump ahead to November. We were way up in North Korea, and we were capturing Chinese. Even though we were capturing them, MacArthur would not believe that the Chinese were there in force. He kept insisting that the division keep moving north. And of course, November 27th, 1950, the Chinese had already infiltrated down. And when the Chinese attacked on November 27th, there was estimated 120,000 were surrounding 17,000 of the division. The division was spread out over 70 miles, one-way road in the mountains. It wasn't long before it was 30 degrees below zero. And that's where it was called the Chosen Few. The Chosen Reservoir was in the middle, the main force of the big supply, and that's where I was located with the ammunition company. And of course, I was, in the meantime, had been operating as the division EOD officer. So it was critical that Hagaru would hold, because the two regiments, the 5th and the 7th, were already north and had to fight their way back. It was only 11 miles, but it took them 10 days to get back under constant fire by the Chinese. That's where the fact that the Marine training is different from the Army, because every Marine would retrain for 2 weeks on weapons, their rifles, machine guns, pistols. And so in essence, officers and all enlisted men and officers through Lieutenant Colonel were trained infantrymen. And so that's what we quickly became, to hold Hagaru, because they would attack every night. In the daytime, if the weather was right, the Air Marine Corps and the Air Force dropping supplies, Hagaru was critical that it had a hold. So we were all infantrymen, and we were receiving airdrops during the day, and then at night the Chinese would attack. So we'd all be on the line, everyone taking charge, realizing this is 30 below zero. So a lot of people were getting severe frostbite, especially the infantry, the two regiments, because they were in the field constantly with little or no protection.
What was the worst thing you had to deal with?
Well, the fact that you were on the line at night, you were only getting a couple hours sleep, you know, you're two of you in a foxhole together. And then in the daytime, we were working to get this ammunition being dropped. So after a few days of that, you just become exhausted. So about the third or fourth day, I've forgotten exactly which, I just became so exhausted, I just had to get rest. So I came in the afternoon and to the what they call the warming tent. I had a tent where it was being heated with a small stove instead of oil or diesel. We used gasoline, so it would be it would glow red. So I told them, look, I need a couple hours of sleep, and don't bother me. I got to have some rest. Shortly after that, I don't know, an hour or two later, one of the men said, Lieutenant, I was a lieutenant then at that time, they're dropping mortars on our tent. Well, that got my attention. Obviously, the mortars were duds. So I got up, and sure enough, they were using 60-millimeter arm mortars they had captured from when they overran the hill. There was a Army unit on the top of what they call East Hill, right where below where we were on the ammunition dump. And they were firing the 60 millimeters at us, but fortunately, they didn't pull the pin. If they had pulled the pin, one mortar would have literally wiped us out.
You wouldn't be here.
We wouldn't be here. Three of them, three duds.
Wow.
So fortunately, they didn't get the word. At that point, you know, you're at such, I said, well, just leave them, and I went back to sleep. You get to that point where you just accept where you are. And so that was, again, you know, act of God or what. But there were about 10, 12 men in the tent. They have all been seriously wounded, because a 60-millimeter mortar is enough to kill quite a few people.
Well, I'm just curious, because when a mortar wounded you in Guadalcanal, you were a young single man.
That's right.
When these dud mortars are landing in your tent near the Chosen Reservoir in Korea,
right,
you're a husband and a father.
That's right. I was.
How difficult was that? Did you feel different in light of that?
Yeah, you know, you just, well, you knew you just had to survive, that's all. you know, we never, what should I say, between the Army and the Marine Corps, there's this esprit de corps that you're just not going to surrender. And that's the way it was. In fact, it became known that the Chinese had orders to annihilate the 1st Marine Division. They were not planning to take any prisoners. So it was, you know, fight or die. So that's the way it was. So when the two regiments got back to Hagaroo, there had been an airstrip. The engineers had gotten an airstrip, and they flew out over 3,000 casualties. Wounded. So then the next stop was from Hagaroo to Cotterie. That's where the 1st Marine Regiment was. That was another 11 miles further south. And so I and my squad, being the EOD, and fortunately we also had some EOD people, a squad, in the engineer battalion. So we worked together whenever it was a big job. And so we were the last to leave. The last night when we were there, of course, they tried to overrun them. We had one battalion, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, and had several tanks. And actually, they did overrun some of the part of the ammunition dump. But fortunately, they say there were two tanks, so I got permission from the CO of the 2nd Battalion to use the fire into the dump. And so firing... into an ammunition dump, really was affected. The next day, there was hundreds of dead Chinese in the area. And so it took another same way by the time we left. We were the last ones to leave the next day. And it took all day from Hagaroo to Cotterie. I didn't get into there until the next night, very late. And then the following day, we're going to leave Cotterie and head down off the mountain. The same thing happened, and there's a write-up in the other book here about there was a correspondent that was able to fly in. Some flew in from Ham Nung, and he was there, and he decided he wanted to stay and see the dumps balloon. And so I told him he couldn't stay with me, that the only way he could stay was if the tankers would accept him. So he did get to the tankers, and they led him to him. So he described the whole operation of blowing the dump at Cotterie. I wasn't even aware of what was going on until years later when the book was written. And my half-brother, who was also in the Marine Corps, same time I was, he was an infantry lieutenant, was enlisted and then became a lieutenant and stayed in, same as I did. He called me and said, "You're in this latest book." So I had completely forgotten about this correspondent. And so he wrote up a detailed article about his observation of that. So that's written in the other books, the Korean War from Busan to Chosin.
In your shadow box of medals on the wall, by your paratrooper wings and your Purple Heart, I saw a Bronze Star. Is that from that
incident? Yeah, I got the Bronze Star from Korea.
So if you guys hadn't blown the dump, the ammunition dump, what do you think would have happened?
Just made it much more, helped a great deal. I mean, there was no shortage of ammunition, so... we probably would have held out, but the fact that I was able to blow up part of the dump made it, killed a lot of Chinese.
Because you were greatly outnumbered.
Oh, yes, greatly outnumbered. They're fully surrounded.
Yeah.
So, but the daytime, then they pulled back because the aircraft came in and the weather permitting, and when the aircraft came in, then they pulled out because the Marines, particularly with their close air support, they would drop napalm. I was on the hill several times where we got the heat of the napalm. It was that close to us. Mm. So if it hadn't been for the air, at daytime we wouldn't have made it. So it was critical that they were able to.
And obviously, I've never done this, and I'm pretty sure most of the people listening have never had to detonate an ammunition dump as a last resort.
Right.
Is there some finesse that's required there? Is there a danger of...
Well, no. There's two ways of doing it. You do it with a fuse, which you light, and you give yourself plenty of time to get away, but not too long, that they can get in. And so what you do, you would triple prime it. Instead of just one charge, you'd put three charges.
Right.
And so out of the three, and they were hidden, you see. So you did that so you were sure they were going to go up, to blow up before they could, you know, overcome. But as you hear in the book, we were just over the hill when the charges went off down in Cotterie. And the same thing when Hagaroo, I make sure everybody was gone. That was in the daytime that we did that. Mm-hmm. And, well, the other was too, but anyway, the charges in Hagaru, we had a lot more ammunition there. The engineers battalion, the engineer had a squad of EOD people too, so it wasn't just myself and my three men. Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention I had, at one time I had five, and the first day we went up to on the hill after the Chinese, the two of them were wounded the first day, and I was on the line for over 24 hours before I had any relief at all. So, but that's the way it was, and there were two army battalions. They came in, and they were mechanized, all mechanized, and they were up on the east side of the reservoir. The Marines, the two regiments, were on the left side, and we were at the base of the 32nd Battalion. The first night was completely overrun because they had Korean soldiers, and they would put them out at night, and then they crawled in their sleeping bags, and they were overrun. It just turned out that the story in the book there, too, that they just ceased to be a fighting organization. They were completely overrun. They were coming out on the reservoir, which, of course, was frozen, but our transport one in charge went out with trucks and picked up stragglers, and some of them had frozen feet, completely frozen black. So we saved quite a few of those. And about 7-8 years ago, I was still living in San Marcos. I came out one day, and my license had a plate around it, chosen few. This man was standing there, and he said, "Is this your car?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'm one of the army that you saved." So that's just kind of touching. It. He said, "I was going to stay here till you came." So the Marines were able to pick up stragglers all the way down. They were in really bad shape. We were evacuated from Ham Hung, went back down to Busan, and then started back up. And that was in January. And so I was there until July. And then it was just a continuation of the same thing, although we were never in the same critical condition we were before. You know, we fought six major battles before I left, and there's an award called the Presidential Unit Citation, if you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. Well, I got one for Guadalcanal, or Gavutu, and two for Korea. So I have three Presidential Unit Citations.
What was it like when you came home from Korea after everything you'd been through, and you got to see your wife and daughter again?
Yeah, it was great. My wife stayed there, and she could have gone back east and stayed with her family, but she decided to stay there and get the house built. And I left her with, as I said, we love dogs, and we had a boxer that was pregnant. And so a night before we left, I guess two nights before, I decided that we took her out and we ran her up and down the beach for about an hour, and she had her puppies that day. So I was able to cut the tails and leave her with 10 dogs and a daughter. So she managed. I mean, she was really great. She stayed and saw the house built. She moved into the house, the first one to move in. And this is when she'd already had the word what was going on, you know, the situation I was in. Some of the battalion was in the rear. The word got down to her to expect the worst, because they didn't really expect us to make it.
Wow.
So she was living with that for a while. And so she was really a wonderful girl and handled it. So then we met in San Francisco and came back down.
I've got a couple more questions. Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for sharing this story with us. As you approach your 100th birthday, what would you say you're most proud of?
Well, I guess I'm just proud of what we were able to accomplish. But the fact that we were married 73 years, I think, is also a wonderful experience. And I'm proud of that, because we were always happy. And even though we had separations, we were separated for about 3 years altogether.
Thanks to Uncle Sam.
Yeah. My wife was able to handle everything. So I just felt that the fact that wrote a story, we were blessed. And that's what I felt.
Yeah.
So after she died, I was encouraged to write a book, and that's what I did.
Picture of Vic and Skippy. We were blessed. Well, and speaking of, I don't want to be melodramatic, but I'm sure this is something you've given some thought to. Here you are, your very first day of combat in World War II. You're wounded, and the guy next to you is killed. Have you ever felt, though, that that wound at that time saved your life?
Well, I'll be honest with you, we were both very active with our church, Episcopalian Church, and I just felt that all the things happened that I was really blessed. Well, for both of us were. That's the best I can say.
You have any advice for the rest of us who might want to make it to 73 years of marriage or age 100?
Well, you know, it's funny, a lot of people have asked me that story, say, why? I said, well, I always get the last word, yes, dear. And my wife was not demanding. She was unusual. She did things that otherwise didn't do. She did her own hair. We never bought anything on time except real estate, of course.
Uh-huh.
We bought the house. But if we couldn't afford pay cash for the car, we just didn't buy it. We paid cash for everything except homes, of course. So that's another thing I try to convince people of, especially young people today.
I saw a picture of you coming home from the Honor Flight with our friends from Honor Flight San Diego. You flew from San Diego to Washington, D.C., to see the National World War II Memorial, which has the gold stars representing 406,000 Americans,
right,
including
right.
30 of your guys in your battalion on your
That's
first
right.
day of combat.
First day, did I mention that James Crist kept track after there were only 38 of us who wrote the book, and he would call me every August, and last August he called me and said, well, there were two others that I just have not been able to get in touch with, so as far as he's concerned, I'm sole survivor of the original battalion, the first parachute battalion that landed in Guadalcanal.
You're the last one alive.
Yeah.
So those who died, you know, more than 400,000 Americans in World War II, more than 50,000 in Korea, you served in both of those.
Right.
How should we today remember those people? What was the significance of their sacrifice?
As far as I was concerned, I only did what I was expected to do, and that's all. I mean, people say, oh, you're a hero, hero. Well, the real hero to me were the corpsmen, the fellows who would come when you were wounded. They'd come and expose themselves and take care of you. Those were true heroes, and they'd expose themselves to take care of the wounded.
Mm-hmm.
What more can you expect than that?
What a treat to spend this hour with Vic Freudenberger. Looking forward to birthday number 100 at the end of January. There were some additional memories of Vic's that we couldn't quite squeeze into our radio time, but they are included in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.